No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host Kathleen Gomez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. We have a very special guest tonight, the first elected United States representative in the District of Columbia, the Honorable Charles Moreland. We're excited to have him here and get his perspective on what's going on in D.C. and elsewhere. So I hope you call in and join the conversation. Again, the number is 888-628-6008 or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. Before I get started, let me introduce my co-host Kathleen, who is back in the land of tornadoes and wide open spaces. Hey, Kathleen, I heard it took you a day and a half to fly from Washington to Kansas. What happened?
I realized what being a proletariat's all about. You know, I get on the plane out of D.C., you know, no problem. My bags are exactly 50 pounds. You know, I had a lot of stuff at your house over the years, so I was real excited, got everything together, didn't leave anything behind. Get to the airport, and we're on the plane, and the pilot says, there's like 9 people in first class, and he says, well, you know, the oven isn't working, and we're just going to spend a little time on ground while we try to get it going. And then I was like in row 10. Right, and I heard the stewardess say, "We're really sorry we can't give you our warm towels, but we are hoping to get it fixed. And if not, you might just have to have salads." And meanwhile, they made about, I guess the rest of us was like 200 and some odd people in the back. They made us all late for a connection. I missed. And then this is a great one. The second one was full. The third one, they missed. It never left Madison. And the fourth one they brought was too full of fuel to land in Kansas. Like, it'd have to go a farther distance. I guess you have to have the exact same amount of fuel in these. Like, if it goes from I guess it was, I guess we're going to Minneapolis to Kansas City. So it scared me because I thought, what if you get hijacked? You can't even, like, fly around and negotiate because you only have enough fuel. So after the fifth airline, I finally got on and got like into Kansas like about 12 hours later. So it was, I mean, you should have heard us all in the back, you know, don't give him the towels, don't give him the towels. We were like so furious.
Well,
but
you're
yes.
A revolutionary. You should have started something.
I was going to.
And you know
I
what?
Was.
I hate to correct you, but you did leave something behind.
Oh,
you left Patty
I
behind. And she's been giving me hell ever since.
I miss her. So. I miss her and her lentils and just the, you know, woman to woman, mano to mano. We had so much in common trying to make you a better man, which I gave up after a year.
Yeah, well, there's only so much you can do. But
that's true.
To start the show tonight, there's big news in the Senate this week. On Thursday, Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, an old friend, has introduced the new Columbia Admissions Act, which is companion legislation to H.R. 317 introduced in the House earlier this year, which would make the District of Columbia the 51st state. Both bills are entitled the New Columbia Admission Act. This legislation in the House has 120 co-sponsors, and the Senate bill was introduced with a record number, 17 co-sponsors, in addition to Senator Carper. So here's a big shout out to Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, Barbara Boxer of California, Cory Booker of New Jersey, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Ben Cardin of Maryland, Chris Coons of Delaware, Richard Durbin of Illinois, Al Franken of Minnesota, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Patrick Leahy, Vermont, Ed Markey, Massachusetts, Barbara Mikulski, Maryland, Patty Murray of Washington, Harry Reid, Nevada, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Charles Schumer of New York, and our old favorite, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Now, for the big bonus gift, Kathleen, can you tell me what all these people have in common?
Are they a Democrat and independent? Isn't
they're
Patrick?
That's right. They're not sitting in first class waiting for the heated towels. They're sitting in the back of the plane with you because they're all Democrats.
That's right.
Absolutely true.
Is Patrick Leahy an independent, or
he's a Democrat, but Bernie Sanders was an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, but he's just changed his party affiliation to run as a Democratic candidate for president. So he's technically a Democrat these days.
Okay. Well, I'm really excited about our guest. And I'd like to tell the audience a little bit about him. He was elected in 1990 as the first representative to the District of Columbia and served two terms. He also got a degree, a BS in international affairs from Antioch University. Along my line, I went to AU and got a degree, BS in international service. He spent time in Europe and West Africa. He did field research in Nigeria. He was admitted to the Pennsylvania Bar in 1980, ran in 1990. He's an activist, an elected official, a lobbyist. He was the chief lobbyist for D.C. voting rights. He is a lawyer. He has a publisher and founder of New Columbia Publishing Company. He is publisher of also the New Columbia Times newspaper and an author, The Way to Freedom from Life's Many Addictions. It's a faith-based healing guide, which sounds like a book that you need to read, Senator Brown, because that's like right up your alley. But this is, you know, he has just done about everything, and he has – I know how many children you have. I know that you were talking about a son. So welcome to the show, Representative Moreland. Thank you so much for being here. We're really kind of excited to hear what you have to say and what you think about the Senate bill.
Thank you so very much. And, of course, I want to start out by thanking Senator Brown for the hard work that he is doing, the good work, the fantastic work that he's doing on the Hill. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, Charles. And let me just add, before we start talking about the Senate bill, that you've been a stalwart. You've been at this longer than I have. And, you know, I consider you a friend. And you've always been a trusted advisor to me. I've got to tell you that lots of people give me advice, but I've always found your advice to be very sound, and I take it very seriously, and I follow it whenever I can, because you really know the stuff in this inside and out, and you're one of the true advocates. You know, there's a handful of you guys, and you know them all, you and Anise Jenkins and a handful of other people that have always been there and have always fought for statehood instead of other interim remedies. So let me ask you, Representative Moreland, what do you think of the Senate bill? Do you, you know, given that we don't think we'll get it through the House and Senate this year, what do you think? You think this is a big deal? I think it's a big deal.
I think it's great. At this particular time, since, you know, I think history is very important. It just reminds me of our absolute greatest supporter on Capitol Hill, who happened to be a senator, and that was Senator Ted Kennedy. When Jesse, myself, Florence, Eleanor, Kevin Chavis, were invited to Capitol Hill. And Senator Kennedy gave a press conference, and I'm just reminded of how much we miss him and his support. However, we're definitely grateful that Senator Carper introduced the bill. Now, as to your statement about what may or may not happen in the House. You know, I think that always the missing ingredient, the one thing that we have needed to get statehood, is a just demand from the people. And where, I mean, I just see these times as a great opportunity for the people to rise up and demand statehood. And the Congress cannot resist a solid, determined demand from the citizens, which is what we need. It's just like the Confederate flag 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
Nobody could have imagined that there would be this groundswell, this snowballing movement to take down that flag. And statehood is pretty much the same way. You know, there's been so much movement. There's been such a long push, and like any wall, when the pressure gets so great, it'll fall suddenly. And that's where our statehood. We are with statehood. A lot of people say we'll never get statehood. It's not going to happen. It's going to be so hard. But if the people rise up and get behind this Senate bill, now is the time.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Representative Moreland, and I went to school at American University, and I lived in D.C. for 10 years. And I never remember, and this was in the 80s, and I never remember really even knowing there was a D.C. flag. Now, I've visited many times, but being back this past year, I was, you know, really, like, moved by how many people are wearing the flag. It's everywhere. It's being, you know, outside all the buildings. And one thing in that I've helped Michael in this movement, because it is something that's really just and really needed. And I've always wondered, where are the people when, you know, you have these events and these rallies? And do you think you see a change now, this, like, in this next year or so, where there'll actually be more of an outpouring by the citizens? Because I agree with you, they really need to act up and say it's enough and it's enough. And I see that kind of bud kind of growing, that you know, flower kind of blooming. Although I hear a lot too, you got two levels of people, the one who live in D.C. and then the people who deal with the federal government. And they kept on saying to me, oh, never in your lifetime. But I feel that it's there, you know, their pulse is really strong. Do you see a change?
Well, I don't see the change that we need yet.
Right.
Because I know that the power is there. No, there's something that is needed. And you know, this, the sad state of disenfranchisement is not a state about which we can do nothing. And the people don't understand that yet. And I think Senator Brown, with what you're doing, and Catherine, with this show, this is the beginning, because it requires education of the people. It requires truth, because there are a whole lot of folks out there who are spreading misinformation and disinformation. You got to understand, this is a struggle for control of the most important piece of real estate on the planet. And so there are opponents, always have been.
With
power, sorry, who are high up. And I said, this is not a fate by which we can do nothing. Yet it is a fate that we will endure as long as we do nothing about it.
Well, you know, I think it's so interesting, Charles, that you bring up the Confederate flag, because, you know, I feel exactly the same way, that there'll be some seminal moment when this injustice will collapse. You know, just like the bus boycott in Montgomery or the Confederate flag. I think people said, you know, they ignored this symbol, which is obviously racist. But when nine people get killed in a church by a maniac, they say enough is enough. You know, enough is enough. We can't tolerate even the kind of any symbol of racism. It's got to go away. And I think there'll be a time in the district when people stand up. You know, I agree with you. There's not enough momentum now, but we've got to keep on building that momentum, because I think there's a time that they'll stand up and say, look, this is an anachronism, political anachronism, that outlived its usefulness 150 years ago. It's terrible. It's wrong. It's against every principle of democracy, and it needs to end.
Well, let me ask you a question, Representative Moreland. You know, were you? How did you become a statehood advocate? You were raised. Were you born in Pennsylvania? You went to school there, and then what made you come to D.C. and become an advocate?
Well, I was born in the state of Georgia, and all I remember growing up was hating this Confederate flag. So that's why it's one of the reasons I
read. I bet. I
moved to D.C. After my father died. And my family decided to move here because there was so much turmoil and turbulence and strife in Georgia. So we moved here and found that there were struggles here, too, at that time. And I got involved in the D.C. freedom movement. What we called it, D.C. Emancipation Movement, when I was interning at the Walter Fauntroy's office. Mm. Walter Fauntroy at that time was organizing and promoting the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. And so we got the D.C. Voting Rights Constitutional Amendment passed in 1978, and had that amendment been ratified, it would have given us two senators and one U.S. representative. Would have also given us the opportunity to participate in the Electoral College and a vote to approve or ratify constitutional amendments and the like. Now, at that time, I had bought into what I look back now and call the incremental approach. And Walter believed in the incremental approach. And so myself, Johnny Barnes, Bob Johnson, we all were, and John Heckinger, we were, Sterling Tucker, we were all supporting Walter's incremental approach. And this was contrary to the stand of Julius Hobson, Joe Butler, and the statehood faction, who said, no, you can't sell out like that. We want statehood. We want statehood. And so Johnny Barnes and I were sent out to go around all the wards, and they had all these forums and debates. And so we were on stage facing Julius Hobson, passionate about statehood, Josephine Butler. And I can remember there was one night when Johnny and I looked at each other and we said, they're right. They're right about this. But the Voting Rights Amendment passed and it had to be ratified. And Julius and Josephine, they all, this thing will never get ratified. You know, there's so many states out there, there's so much opposition. It ought to be about the full measure of our rights, and that's statehood. Don't compromise. If it ever passes, we'll never be a state. So I was, after my internship, I was hired as the primary lobbyist going around the state, testifying at before state legislatures. And we were facing a really, real organized group of people, well-funded group. Everywhere we went, they were there with the same argument. You know, so we knew that there was all this money against this, our, you know, this bill that was giving us a measure of freedom. They were organized. They were out there. And they defeated us. We only got 16 states to ratify, Maryland being the very first. So we got 16 states to ratify, and it failed. I think it... we had 7 years to get it ratified, and it was never ratified. So after that, it was just a natural for me to get involved in the statehood movement. Now, once I was elected, another funny thing happened. Once I was elected, after I had served for a year and a half, Josephine Butler came to me and she said, Charles, you need to watch out. She said, we thought that you were an agent provocateur when you ran, because we knew you were on the other side before. She said, but now we realize that you are very, very serious. I was, you know, I went into it, burning my tax returns down on the steps of the IRS. We were holding tea parties on Capitol Hill where we were dumping tea in the streets. Jesse Jackson, myself, Florence, the mayor, you know, people were getting arrested for the first time in a long time. So Josephine said, but now we realize that you are a strong supporter. You need to watch out because they will do damage to you. Then she told me this story about how when Julius first started the statehood movement, he was strong and healthy. And she told me that all of a sudden he came down with cancer, she came down with cancer. A couple of other people she mentioned came down with this terrible, terrible disease. And she said, you better watch out because they will do damage and harm to anybody that tries to change this system of government. So I thought that was very, very, very curious.
Well, and you know, incrementalism is still out there. I went to a forum the other night, they had Jim Moran there and former Republican Congressman Tony Williams, former mayor, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and incrementalism. You know, there was a lot of talk about incrementalism. We've got the mayor now standing up for budget autonomy, and we've got, fights for legal autonomy. And it's not any harder, in my opinion, to get statehood logistically than it is to get those other things. And I think that those other things are a diversion. So what can we do to get, since you were converted, what can we do to convert people? Because there are a lot of them out there that say, yeah, what we need is budget autonomy, which, by the way, is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It violates the Home Rule Charter. And, Article 1, Section 8 is pretty clear cut in all cases whatsoever. Congress can do whatever it wants with the district, and I don't think Congress wants to give us budget autonomy. So what can we do to get people, do you think, Charles, to understand that, you know, this is just another form of inequality? When we go to, you know, if we get budget autonomy, or if we get one vote, or if we get, you know, any of the other solutions that have been put out there besides statehood, it's just a different form of equality, and we've had inequality, and we've had lots of different forms of inequality over the years.
Senator, you're absolutely correct. It is only with that mindset, with your mindset, that we will be able to conquer and defeat this evil plague of taxation without representation and put an end to congressional tyranny and oppression of the citizens of Washington, D.C. We have to do what you're doing. And this is great. I mean, this is fantastic. This message of truth. And we have to join with like-minded individuals and just convince people that the power ultimately belongs to the people. Now, there are some folks out there who are genuinely confused.
Yes.
By this incremental approach. There are people out there who are just bound by and held down by a lack of faith, disbelief, and doubt that's been planted in them over the years. My wife, just a couple of days ago, I was talking about statehood, and she looked at me very sincerely. She said, "Well, we'll never get this." And I told her, I said, "Listen, you have to understand that Martin Luther King said that the universe bends towards justice. And if that's true, and I believe it is,
yes,
then too. It is the injustice of this so-called home rule, which is another name for home, another name for it is home food. This incremental home rule cannot prevail injustice cannot prevail. We have to let people know this, that it is justice, which means statehood must ultimately prevail. And statehood is inevitable, not injustice. So a lot of our people just believe that injustice will prevail over the citizens of Washington, D.C. forever. I don't believe that. It's the message of hope that you all are spreading today. And I just emphasize over and over and over, I'm just so pleased and so proud of what you're doing, Senator. But it takes just a few more people like you and your supporters to get out there and be consistent, be faithful, because eventually this wall of oppression is going to collapse under the pressure. But, yeah, we do need the people, and who knows what it will take. I think a call from you and I today for the people of Washington, D.C. to rise up and demand your freedom. Rise up and demand. This system cannot resist a just demand for freedom from the citizens of Washington, D.C. People around the world will join you.
I agree. I think this is an injustice that cannot stand on its own, you know, and I think there are a lot of sincere people, like you say, people like your wife, who don't think it's going to happen. They're not against it. They just can't see it. And I think we need to paint that picture for them. I think you're absolutely right. I've been in national politics a long time, and so is Kathleen. And who would have, in 2005, predicted that we would have had an African-American president? Nobody. You don't know when history is going to change. You just got to push and push and push until it does, I think.
Well, it's funny because...
emphasizing what you say, like the waves lapping endlessly against the shores of subjugation and tyranny. I used to say that in my speeches. If each citizen takes the responsibility for establishing a foothold for freedom and democracy, dragging back each time to lap against the shores of hopelessness, a simple grain of sand, we will become a state not in some distant future.
Right.
But now, today, I'm not going to pass this struggle down to my son.
And that's a big thing. Today. It's time to stop passing it down to our children.
Right. Exactly.
Well, let me ask you kind of a hard question. I have always been, and, you know, I lived in D.C., left, kind of came back, always been critical of the city council because I don't believe you really have, don't know Brandon Todd or LaRubi that well, but from what I've seen, I don't believe that this city council really wants statehood. I mean, to me, if you want statehood, you need to put money into the effort, because as you know, sir, when you lobby, you know, the whole idea that this is a volunteer movement doesn't hold weight with people. You know, a credible movement has people, number one, behind it, but has investment, you know, money, especially from those who you've elected to lead you in D.C., should be leaders of this movement. And do you think that maybe statehood has to be raising in their campaign so that you know that they're a true believer and they're going to work for it? Or are they going to just, you know, I think be more content to be in their kingdom and try and say, well, we're going to go for budget autonomy? What do you think needs to be done in the city council?
Wow, Kathleen, that is a fundamental issue. And quite frankly, the council and the mayors in the past have been the biggest problem. We have to, first of all, start at, you know, at home, at the very top. One thing, the D.C. council and members of the state of delegation, we have to respect the movement and respect the people in the movement. We have to respect you know, our D.C. delegation starting. First of all, don't call them shadows. Anybody, and Senator Brown, you know, if somebody makes a mistake and introduces me as the first elected shadow representative, I straighten them out immediately. I don't care who it is. It could be President Obama. First thing I just let them know, D.C. citizens are not shadow citizens. they're real citizens. A shadow is nothing. It has no substance. It's zero, nothing. And so when you call somebody a shadow, words mean something. So when you call yourself or call the D.C. Congressional delegation shadows, it undermines everything they do. And that's how the council, first undermines what's being done, undermines the movement. And when we first ran, Jesse, Florence, and I, we were elected, and nobody called us shadows. I was the United States, D.C.'s first elected United States representative. That's what's on the ballot. That's what the citizens vote for. And it was certainly not in the a part of the statehood committee's recommendations when we first approved voting for the statehood delegation. But I was with Ann Laukow, and we were researching, and we saw that sometime in I believe it was 2001, 2002, the D.C. Council had started to refer to the members of the statehood delegation as shadow representatives. That got pretty much made it official. But yeah, you're right, Kathleen. The D.C. Council and the mayor, if they were serious about our freedom, about statehood, they would fully fund the statehood delegation, give them salaries, and put some power behind the movement. But I do believe that they are, in a sense, in reality, they're collaborators. They are part of the system. They're comfortable where they are. In fact, the Home Rule Charter, they know it's a violation of democratic principles that anywhere in America, if you try to take the so-called system of government that we have in D.C., if you try to take home rule in any other state, the citizens will pick up guns and shoot you dead.
Yeah.
one of the problems that I'm beginning to point out is that the Home Rule Charter, by limiting the number of Democrats that can run for the council at any one time, you know, when two at-large council members run, only one can be a Democrat. That has had a disparate impact on the constitution of the council. So you have people elected to the council that would never be there on the Democratic system. You probably have four Democrats at-large rather than two. And the makeup of the council would be different. So it affects the council, and they are comfortable being overseers on the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
They're privileged.
I agree.
Yeah,
they're
I think that, you know, just to point this out, and you may not know about this yet, Charles, because it really hasn't gotten out there, but there was a report at the last Democratic State Committee where they want to sanction people who change a party to no party to run for those empty seats. Instead of standing up and saying this is wrong, you shouldn't exclude Democrats, they're finding ways to be comfortable with it. And you're right, it's absolutely wrong, and these guys need to stand up. They do. And I just want to point out,
they're standing up for statehood. The statehood,
yes.
That's it.
That you are one of the people that has pushed hard for legislation that stood still in the city council for more than 2 years now to actually fund the delegation. And they've come up with this crazy-ass idea of a commission that they're going to partially fund, and the mayor and the chairman of the city council are going to be head of the commission. And, you know, I'm not taking any money from those guys. The other members of the delegation are, but I said, look, I'm not working for the mayor, and I'm not working for the chairman of the city council. I was elected by the people, and that's who I should work for. So I think you're absolutely right. They're comfortable. They don't see as much benefit in becoming a state as the rest of us do, because, frankly, it doesn't benefit them as much as it benefits the people of the District of Columbia. They're the second highest paid. They're the highest paid part-time city council in America. They're second only to Los Angeles, that has five times our population, and it's full-time. So, you know, some councilmen make $300,000 a year. David Catania made more than $300,000 a year. Michael Brown made more than $300,000 a year. So they're comfortable, but we need to get them to stand up. And then I think some of them are truly believe in the incremental approach, but it's not. I keep on thinking about the image of somebody saying to Rosa Parks, "Well, we'll let you sit in the middle of the bus." You know, that's what incrementalism is to me. You know, civil rights, I really don't see them as incremental ever. I think that people stand up and demand their rights. I also think we're going through a period now with the ruling from the Supreme Court about gay marriage and the Confederate flag and all these other things that are coming up. Ferguson, Kathleen and I have had people on the show from Ferguson. I think people are starting to question the entire civil rights thing again in the United States, and hopefully we'll be part of that. We'll be part of that awareness.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Senator. We have to get the council in order. Kathleen, you asked me the question. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's once they're elected, somebody takes them in the back room and they drink the Kool-Aid.
Right, but, drink the water.
Yeah. But they, and Senator Brown, I have to disagree with you. I don't think that any of them are foolish enough to really believe in the incremental approach as being the solution. Because if they grant us every one of those increments, the citizens of D.C. will still be disenfranchised and will still be political slaves. The only solution is statehood. But when they run for office, we the statehood movement, and those of us who understand, we really need to hold their feet to the fire and make them say whether they support statehood or not. Now, they've become a lot more deceptive in recent years. When they stand before certain audiences, they will say statehood.
Yes.
But when they are comfortable and being truthful in their real beliefs, they say voting rights. Well, voting rights, the so-called voting rights bill, is a clever strategy that they use to make it appear to people around the country and the people in D.C. that it's something that is useful, that you know, they use the voting rights bill and hide behind that. But this D.C. voting rights bill resembles real freedom and voting rights about as much as a jackass resembles a thoroughbred horse. You know, from a distance, they have the same features, but when you break it down and look at it, the so-called voting rights bill, it's nothing. It's still going to leave us disenfranchised, second-class American citizens. And these council members know, and they understand that what the people voted for, what the people approved, by referendum, is full-fledged statehood, because any other entity, this is the United States of America, and it's simple. Any other any entity that is not a state is superior to the states. That's the way the Constitution is written. If you're a territory, if you're a possession, if you're a district, your rights are inferior. But the citizens of Washington, D.C., we have all the responsibilities and duties that other citizens have. Some of these other entities don't pay taxes. They don't have all the duties. We have all the duties and responsibilities, but we don't have all the rights. That's unfair. And the members of the D.C. Council know that. They understand that. At some point, they sell out.
Yeah, they do sell out.
Well, that's one of the more frustrating.
At some point, they sell out.
Yeah.
And one of the more frustrating things about this is exactly what you say. Everything that's not statehood is something less. You know, when you look at something like we think that separate but equal was a concept that was thrown out in 1954 in the Brown versus Board of Education case. You know, so it's frustrating to sit there and let these people stand up and say, yes, we can be separate and still be equal. We can't be.
And I think that, you know, for the audience that's listening that's not from D.C., we do have a good following. I think people don't understand that, first of all, what amazes me, D.C., you must be at like $1.8 billion or something you've paid so far this year in taxes. And, right? Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when I'm in Arizona and something the federal government or the government does to me, my first reaction is to call my representative and to call my senator and get them. I mean, of course, the challenge is to get them involved in helping my case, but I vote for them or I'm their constituent and they feel somewhat the need to listen to my issues to see if they can help me out. Well, you all have nothing. I mean, I don't think people understand that if your identity is stolen and you live in D.C., who do you go to help you? I mean, you know, most people can go to their U.S. senator and, like I said, rep, you guys have, it's kind of unclear to me who you go for help, and yet you pay this so much taxes, and when you vote, it really is kind of, and that's a hard thing to understand, it's kind of less of a vote. Am I correct?
Well, yeah, you're right. Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, and it may be a little technical for some people, but yeah, even under the 23rd Amendment, which they use all the time, the Republican the other night said, well, they could have made the district a state when they made passed the 23rd Amendment, but they didn't. The truth is that it's ridiculous that we had to wait until the election of Lyndon Johnson to actually cast a vote for president. But, you know, you're absolutely right about that. It's
but don't you have something
even under the 23rd Amendment, we only get three electoral votes. So someday if the population of the district is 2 million people, we still only get three electoral votes. We even have a limited right. And people think this is theoretical, but it's not. Back in the 1980s, when we had 800,000 people, we should have had one more electoral vote that we didn't get. And so we should have had one more vote than Wyoming. But the amendment says no more than the smallest state. So and that would always be three. So, yeah, we're limited all across the board.
Let me ask you a question.
I'm sorry, Charles.
Director.
Go ahead.
We have no power, no voice in the Congress, nobody to go to. Our delegate does not have a single vote. Now, under this, the shame of it, and it's clear, under this magnificent U.S. Capitol dome, the members of Congress gather as equals to participate in this never-ending feast of American democracy. Every citizen from every state in the union is represented by two senators and one United States representative at the table, each one with an equal vote. But our delegate sits at that banquet with an empty plate, while citizens of D.C. are servants at the banquet table of democracy. And we have to, first of all, get our citizens to see it in that way. How ridiculous this form of oppression is. It's political slavery.
It is. It is. That's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I see we have a caller on line two. Let's see if she has a question for Representative Moreland. Bonnie, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Kathleen and Michael.
Hello.
Hey.
And Representative Moreland, I just wanted to, pardon me?
Do you have a question?
Not really a question. It's just sort of a statement. Representative Moreland, I just want to thank you for your service to our community. I think that you've done a great job. And I find it extremely sad that we have 650 or almost 700,000 people that live in this district, and we're not equal to the rest of the world. I am apolitical, but I am a Democrat, and I say apolitical because I've been part of other parties, but I find the Democrat Party to be closer to what I actually believe in. And I just don't know, and I chose to move here 26 years ago, and the first person I met was Michael. So he turned me into a Democrat, I think. But
wasn't easy. It's hard work.
But I just don't know how to make people change their ideas about why we shouldn't be a state like everybody else. I mean, we're very small. Rhode Island is small, too, and they've got less people that live there than we have that live here. And we're the center. We are the center of the world with regard to politics, and it just drives me crazy.
Well, you know, Bonnie, we hear this argument from time to time that you're not big enough to be a state. We're actually larger in population than two other states, North Dakota and Vermont. And our system of government is based on population mostly, and not on the physical size. That's why you don't have 21 senators in California and only one senator in Rhode Island. It's based on population. Senators to a state, of course, but representatives in Congress are based on population, and we certainly have a large enough population to have a voting representative, which we don't have.
And, you know, I had another thing I wanted to say. I can't remember what it is, but I just find it sort of appalling that the rest of the – oh, no, I know what it was. Michael, when you and I and Pat attended, I think it was Obama's first campaign, we went to Mr. Henry's after – not campaign, sorry, his inauguration – went to Mr. Henry's, and we ran into a parliamentarian from England that had no clue that the District of Columbia didn't have the same rights as the rest of the people in the United States. And I just found it really interesting when Representative Moreland said that we need to take this global rather than just kind of talking among ourselves, that maybe if we tried to do something like that, other people would be as appalled as we are.
Well, I think that's a good point, and thanks for making it. Yes, I think when we export democracy all around the world, that it's somewhat of an embarrassment to our government that we don't provide it here at home. And, you know, Jack Kemp, who was one of our few Republican allies on anything, said one of the reasons that he was for the D.C. Voting Rights Act, not something I was for, but something he was for, was because when he went to China, that was the first thing the Chinese said to him when he was a cabinet secretary. Don't preach to us about human rights when you don't allow the people of your nation's capital to participate. So thanks for calling in with that comment. We appreciate it. Charles, what do you think? You think, how do we go global with this?
Well, we, you know, all politics is local.
Yes.
But we have to get the message out. And we have examples of how to do it. The civil rights movement. What happened in Ferguson and Baltimore. When the people send the message out to the oppressor that we are fed up, that we're not going to take it anymore. We're going to take our seat at the front of the bus. We're going to go and occupy seats in the restaurant, fit in, and demand to be served. And the world will gather behind you and support you. But who can support slaves, political slaves, who won't stand up for their own rights? And that's what we have to do in D.C. We have to stand up for our own rights, and then the support is out there. People support justice. People support freedom. People support democracy. You know, that's easy. But what we have to do, and we can no longer, you know, say that we're confused and we don't know. This is a no-brainer. We have to stand up for our rights and demand the full, you know, our the rights that every other American enjoys as a birthright. We got to stand up and demand it right now. Let's send that message out, Senator Brown.
Let me ask you, Representative Moreland. You talk about politics being local. You know, I love Ward 8. I love going over there, and Michael's, you know, always involved in Ward 8. But what do you think of the fact that in this last, you know, recent council race in Ward 8, the winning candidate got less than 2,000 votes. Only 14% of the registered voters went to the polls in Ward 8, you know, and you know, he Trayon White only lost by 78 votes. I mean, you know, there to me, I think if anyone understands what statehood would bring to them and what it means, is getting out to vote. I mean, what do you think is happening in Ward 8, and why was there such a low turner voter turnout?
Not just Ward 8, but all over the city. You know, I think the miracle is that people in Washington, D.C. turn out to vote at all for this illusory system of justice. The politicians in D.C. are they're make-believe politicians pretending at democracy. And maybe the citizens of Washington, D.C. are wise enough to understand that. I mean, we know that Congress actually controls D.C. We know that every bill, every regulation, every piece of legislation is chilled by congressional oversight. So I won't, you know, what we see is what happens to slaves. We're political slaves. So this is a slave mentality. So I'm not surprised that the slaves have a slave mentality. That happens in every slave system. So I won't blame the victims for the crime. If we had governors, if we had two senators and a voting U.S. representative, I think the message would get out to the people of Washington, D.C. that democracy means nothing. But this make-believe democracy, the people are pretending at politics. Oh, no, I don't blame the victims for this crime, but we have to motivate people and educate people and get people to understand the power of real democracy, and that's what we ought to fight for. So, no,
I agree 100%.
I think people should vote, but when they don't vote, I'm not going to blame them. What are they voting for? Certainly, if you had two senators.
I agree with you.
To motivate people. When you could impact and affect American politics. Yeah, the people out there in Ward 8, and not just Ward 8, but all throughout the city, they are wise enough and have sense enough to know that this ain't politics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and
this ain't democracy.
You know,
this is make-believe.
You mentioned Ferguson.
Michael, you mentioned, don't want to get me fired up on issues like that.
He got you going.
Well, you mentioned Ferguson. You mentioned Ferguson and you mentioned Baltimore, and it's true. I think that the country rallied around. I think there's two things going on here. They rallied around these issues because they see them in their own hometown. And that's one problem that we have, is we're really the only ones affected by this particular ailment in the city. So we got to, I mean, in the country. So we got to figure out a way to make other people feel our pain. But we have to start it. If the people of Baltimore had not stood up and the people of Ferguson had not stood up, the rest of the country wouldn't have been there to support them. They would have, you know, that would have been it. And that's one of our big problems, I think, is our tacit acceptance of all this. And we got it.
But everybody in America and everybody around the world can understand this simple proposition. Taxation without representation is tyranny. This is the oldest battle and the most noble struggle in American history. So we have to stand up and let people know that we're not, and bring the issue home. This is an evil system, taxation without representation. And the worst part of it is that they take our own locally raised money and they tell us what we can and cannot do with it. And so this congressional tyranny, it affects every law, every bill, you know, every piece of legislation that comes out of our council. For instance, if you look at the tags, what do our tags say? Taxation without representation. What does that mean? We all going around cheering about that. That means nothing. That is a sellout. The tag should say no taxation without representation. And it's not that the council members don't know, because when they got ready to pass that bill, I told them, don't sell out. Make a statement. No taxation without representation. Stop taxation without representation. But just to say taxation without representation, because our council is terrified. The legislation that comes out of that council is chilled by congressional oversight.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word because we're running out of time here. And we had a song that we're going to play in honor of Representative Moreland. I think we'll go out with it in a minute. Any last comments from you, Kathleen? Anything else you want to say to Charles Moreland other than thank you, thank you, thank you? And thank
well,
you,
yes.
A personal thank you from me, Charles, because I'm embarrassed to say that I used to use the word shadow until Charles Moreland jumped on my back a bunch of times and convinced me that I was doing a disservice by doing that. And he's absolutely right. I've never used it since. And I thank you for that, Charles, and the many other things you've done for this city. Anything else you want to say, Kathleen?
Well, just to reiterate what you said, I mean, I just find it really encouraging to hear the way you speak, because I think your city council has to lead also, and since they get elected, they need to be making that statement. So I've always been somebody who's criticized them very much, and I'm glad to know that I'm not crazy, that is a big problem, and the residents need to address it. And thank you so much, Representative Moreland, for being there to voice it so well and so concise on what the issue is. And we just have to wake everybody up and give them a shot of coffee, a Red Bull, whatever it is that's needed to get them up and on their feet and off their chairs and out of this, you know, kind of domicile kind of thinking that it's just not going to be in our lifetime. Well, nothing, if you think that way, will ever be in your lifetime if you accept it. So thank you so much, and we hope you'll come back again.
Yeah, we hope you'll come back soon. And by the way, Kathleen, don't confuse being crazy with being right, because I think you're both. But here's in honor of Representative Moreland, we're going to go out with a song from Nina Simone, which I think expresses what we all feel in this city. We wish we knew how it would feel to be free. Thank you, Charles. Thank you, America. See you next week.
Give the people their right to vote.